Hello, Sonny. I suppose you know you're listening to the Punk News Podcast for the week of July 30th, 2013. And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. And with me is the great ghoulish writer, reviews editor, the ghoulish master, Brian Yancey. Brian Yancey, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for that wonderful intro.
And also with us is the master of macabre, the managing editor, Adam White. Adam White, how is your necromancy doing these days?
I figure I'm at least like the Vincent Price of punk news at this point.
And of course, with us is the horror that may not be named, the horrors who name, which we never speak, but we refer to in the sobriquet as Sound Guy Nairman, who is with us always and manipulates us, our minds, through his alien godlike powers. So let us tilt our head downwards in tribute to the unknown grotesque horror that controls all of our recordings.
Kneel before Zod!
Now, you might be wondering why we're acting so possessed. Because it's I'm possessed with joy. Because, in case you punk news listeners out there know, Southern Records just re-released Rudimentary Penai's seminal album, Cacophony, which is a genius album. It's up there with the Misfits. It's up there with Black Flag. It's up there with the Ramones, if you ask me. What it is it's a record by a band called Rudimentary Penai, who not a whole lot of people know in the States, but they're pretty popular. Well, actually, they're not even that popular in England, to tell you the truth. But Rudimentary Penai came out of the whole Crass movement. Their second EP was on the Crass label, and then they put out a couple of records. I think one of their three or four main masterpieces is Cacophony. What Cacophony is, it's vocalist Nick Blinko, who actually went so insane while recording this that they actually locked him up in a prison for about 7 years after this album was released. Cacophony is him blending together his own views of insanity and the dark arts with the writing of H.P. Lovecraft. Southern Records just re-released it. The album has about 30 tracks, but there's really about 50 movements in it. And it's insane. There's just all these references to H.P. Lovecraft, demons, but also it's also like a metaphor for Blinko himself and his own insanity and those kinds of things. We're going to play three tracks from here, because you can't really get an idea of what the album is like just from one song. But within the three tracks, there's actually five movements. The five movements that we're going to listen to is Lovecraft, Baby, Buzzing Voice, Dream City, Drinking Song from the Tomb, which Mr. Brew covered, and C12, H22011. So once again, this is a selection from one of my all-time favorite records out on Southern Records, Cacophony by Rudimentary Penai.
We're just such broken news. The city is a mirror, a broken run, there's a pouring in town, a shadowy staircase Sartorium, the shabbiest of dancing nights in a place that the Yokohama nation knew. Go, it's rising, strata of wonders quickly fall. The gleam of dreams is brighter than the glister of fossilized pageants. On your platter a man on his feet, for it is eating and drinking that bring us relief. So fill up your glass, for life will soon pass. When you're dead, you'll ne'er drink to your king or your ass. An equian had a red nose, so they say, but what's a red nose if you're happy and gay? God split me, I'd rather be red whilst on here than white as a lily and dead half a year. So Betty, my miss, come give me a kiss, and hell is no innkeeper's daughter like this. Young Harry propped up just as straight as he's able, will soon lose his wig and slip under the table. But fill up your goblets and pass them around, better under the table than under the ground. So revel and chaff as you thirstily quail, and the 6 feet of dust is let easy to lap. The fiends strike me blue, I'm scarce able to walk, and damn it, I can't stand upright or choke. He'll land a bit better than some other chair, I'll try hope for a while, for my wife is not there. So lend me a hand, I'm not able to stand, but some gay whilst I linger on top of the land.
I spiked his drink. I smell the most in common. It's candy and chocolate ones like the afternoon variety. Sweet mist and lime substance. Save for all the swings into it. One more. Save for all the swings into it. Save for all the swings into it. What the fuck you? Save for all the swings into it.
But when it first did help to wound itself, now these, our princes, are come home again. Come the three corners of the world in arms, and we shall shock them. Naught shall make us rue if England to itself be true.
And we're back from our dark arts. How do you guys feel after practicing our dark arts and searching into unknown knowledge and dangerous techniques?
Itchy.
Deeply troubled.
Well, speaking of being deeply troubled, we got a lot to talk about the Punk News podcast tonight, and we're all deeply troubled here. And of course, you listeners know you can always email us at podcast@punknews.org. We got a bunch of mail lately, so keep it coming. But we're going to start off with a Brian Fallon strikes back, much like Star Wars Episode 5, the Gaslight Anthems. Brian Fallon, he commented on Cover Request in a pretty lengthy post. He basically said, you know, I'm going to play what I'm going to play. You're not guaranteed a particular show. Please don't yell out covers. A brief excerpt of his long speech, which you can read on the Gaslight Anthem website, reads thusly. I'm asking that if anyone would like to come to our show, please come because you want to see what we're doing on that night. Don't come to hear a cover. It probably won't happen. Don't come to yell at me when I'm trying to share something with the audience to reach out to them about something I feel is moving me. For some reason, I'm the one with the microphone, which may be a mistake entirely. But if you want to have, but if you want one and have something to say, please start a band, get in the band, sleep on floors, and work your butt off. And maybe one day I'll find your band and I'll come see you play. So, you know, this really was polarizing the punk rock community. A lot of people seem to say that, you know, I feel you, Brian Fallon. You know, we want to hear you make the art that you want to make. You're not a jukebox. While other people seem to say, you know what, Holmes, you've been playing up the Bruce Springsteen and Joe Strummer art for the past 8 years. You can't turn your back on it now. So what do you guys think?
Here's my thing. And hopefully this will make sense. Bands don't owe their fans stuff like that. Now, some bands accommodate those fan requests and do so happily, you know. But the problem becomes, once that happens, some fans will expect every band will do that, and not all bands work that way. I mean, you take a band like the Gaslight Anthem, they have a whole bunch of songs. They have a pretty extensive discography at this point. and they're going to play what they want to play, which, yes, they've done a lot of covers, but generally it's going to be their songs. And for a fan to, like, buy a ticket to a show just to scream out stupid bullshit between songs or during songs or after songs or whenever, it just reeks of entitlement, and it really upsets me, because that's not what going to a show is supposed to be about, for the most part. Now, again, if you're at, like, a show where that's encouraged, that's fine, but you have to know what situation you're in, what band you're seeing, and how to act appropriately, because, you know, the band is up there to entertain the entire audience, not just you, and it's really strange how at seemingly every show there is that guy or that girl or that person who feels the need to just scream out bullshit between songs. Now, sometimes it's kind of funny, you know, the band will play along with it, but at the same time, you know, it can ruin shows for people. I mean, it's entirely possible. And I actually saw the Gaslight Anthem. I mean, I've seen them a bunch of times, but the time that I was reminded of that I saw them by this story was right after American Slang came out. And at that point, they were a pretty big band, not as big as they are now, but they were just starting to kind of cross over from the punk scene to the kind of dad rock scene, I guess. So this was not a punk show. There were, there were punks there for sure, but it was definitely an older crowd. You know, there was a lot of older guys there who, you know, probably don't go to a lot of shows anymore. And, you know, they were just screaming for songs the entire time. Both Gaslight songs, Springsteen songs, or just screaming Springsteen, you know, apropos of nothing. And it gets really grating. And it's not really funny the first time, and it's not really funny the second time. And people should just stop doing it. But Brian Fallon can write all the blogs he wants, unfortunately. It probably will never stop. But I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
There's a certain amount of, I want to say savvy, but it's not really savvy. It's kind of like, I don't know, having like a fucking clue where you are, that you need, I think, when you're seeing a band live, where it should be pretty readily apparent to you what kind of show it is. And, you know, if it's a big, you know, crazy raucous show and the band's taking requests, then by all means, you know, shout out things that you want to hear them play. At the same time, I think, you know, we all know that there's, you know, you go and see a certain band and they're at a certain point in their career and they're not going to play certain songs for whatever reason. You know, they may have moved on from that style that may be indicative of something that, you know, that they don't think they are anymore. Maybe a song that the band hates from having overplayed it or whatever. And, you know, when you go to one of these shows, if it's a band that you seem to care about, you generally know at least that much. So if you're standing there in the crowd, unless you're, I don't know, a complete dummy who is completely blind to the overall story of the band, what the band's been doing, it should be pretty readily apparent, you know, either A, if you should be shouting out stupid shit, and B, which shit you should probably not be shouting out at all. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for people that will go to a show like this and just yell things. And this isn't a comment with the Gaslight Anthem. I don't think that, you know, the Gaslight Anthem are, you know, they're capital A artists and they're more precious than everyone else, so they can't have stuff yelled at them. It's not that. I don't really care about the Gaslight Anthem. It's more just, you know, if it's a band that you care about, you pretty much know the things that you should or shouldn't yell at them. And I don't really know if, you know, alcohol is really an excuse for, you know, throwing that rule out. You know, people can have plenty of drinks at a show and not become like a huge raging dick. So I don't know. It's kind of like, if you're going to be a jerk, then don't do that. I don't really know where I was going with that point, but I mean, it's a savvy thing. I mean, you know, and
yeah,
I don't want to pull specific bands out of my hat here about who do this, but you know, you would not go see, I don't know, Mill and Colin play and yell a bunch of ska songs at them that they don't want to play, because you know that they're not going to do it, and it's just going to piss everyone off. And it might be funny, I don't know, if one person yells it once, but not like funny in a the whole community thinks this is funny way. More funny in like a ha, listen to that asshole But that kind of comedy gets tired really quick. So,
yeah,
you know, if don't be that guy. Like, I hate to say that because you want to say to people, you know, be smarter. But that, I guess people who need that advice don't really take it. So I don't know. It sort of bums me out that he has to write this sort of thing. On the one hand, you know, you figure that, like, a band like Gaslight that has, like, the level of success that they have, you know, they put on shows that are big enough, you know, that attract the number of people that they do. They resonate with enough people. They're not a big, goofy band that, you know, even on the best of days, I would expect people just to be, like, barking out requests at them. You wouldn't think that they would need to do this. So it's sort of weird that it is. And there's, I'm not going to lie, there's a part of me that's thinking, like, you know, get a thicker skin, tell the guys to fuck off and play whatever you want, but at the same time, you know, can't tell someone how to feel, so, yeah.
You know, though, Adam, actually, I think you and I disagree on the facts, the fundamental facts. I think Gaslight Anthem is either in an enviable or an unenviable position in that they're still sort of underground, but they're also sort of mainstream as well. Now, I know in the punk scene, people are like, what are you talking about, John? Gaslight Anthem is huge. But let's see how many likes Gaslight Anthem have on Facebook. I think it's like 250,000. Real quick. 260,000, which sounds huge. But as I discovered just the other day, a heavy metal band called Five Finger Death Punch has 2.7 million fans. And Yancey, what was that band that had 16 million fans?
Avenged Sevenfold had.
Avenged, right. So,
million Facebook likes.
So that means Avenged Sevenfold is about 72 times as big as Gaslight Anthem. So they're really not that big, but they're big enough that, you know, they play them on mainstream radio and stuff. So what that means is whenever you're a really big band, you're going to have a lot. See, what we need to realize as part of, you know, the music critic community or the music fan community or the punk community is we really process music a lot different than most people. Like my mom... Like, my mom doesn't sit around and listen to a CD and, like, listen to every track. She basically just wants the hits. When you go see AC/DC, most people there just want the hits. Even when you go see the Rolling Stones, most people just want the hits. So when you achieve a certain level of fame, you get people who just have the greatest hits CD or, like, one CD, and they just want to hear the jam that you have on the radio. And so I think those are the people that are yelling to Gaslight Anthem. Now, because Gaslight Anthem isn't mega huge, they can still hear those people, whereas, you know, Brian Johnson of AC/DC can't hear the Jackass yelling "Let there be rock" in the 97th row, you know. So that's why he's hearing this, is because a lot of people are going to the show because they're not huge fans. They just want to hear a couple of stupid jams that they know from the radio, and they're not going to a concert for a deeply emotional concert like we would. They're going to a show just to hear the hits, like a jukebox.
Well, no, but I think I gotta say what's happening here is it's not so much people shouting out, you know, play 59 Sounds, the 59 Sound or whatever their singles have been. It's people are going out here and they're shouting out like Springsteen covers or, you know, Clash covers or whatever, and they're wanting to hear them play of that. Now, on the one hand, yeah, you know, Gaslight's created a reputation of, you know, of covering those bands, so it's not necessarily the unexpected thing that you'd hear at the show, and I think that's really what he's more on about is that, you know, don't come here and shout out covers.
So you think it's the mega fans shouting that out as opposed to the casual fans?
I don't really know who's shouting it out because, again, going back to what I was saying, you figure that if you're the mega fan, you're not going to be a giant dick because you're going to know, being a mega fan, that, you know, Fallon's not the kind of guy that's got the... you know, the stomach for that sort of thing. So, I mean, that's where I'm going with. I'm having a hard time figuring out who is shouting out stuff like that for him. Like, it's a casual fan, but it's a casual fan that at least that has the knowledge that, you know, they do these covers. So, I don't know, maybe they're up there playing one of their new things, and this guy's going like, fuck that, play Born to Run! Or,
yeah, I would also say that... And this is, I wouldn't say this is necessarily true of all casual fans of the Gaslight Anthem or casual fans of bands like that, but, I mean, John, you brought up a point that you basically said that, you know, they're just there to hear the hits. Well, I mean, I would argue that the band is going to eventually play those hits, so shouldn't the fan be self-aware and know that instead of just yelling them out every song until they play them?
Yeah, but I'm saying those people aren't that self-aware. See, they're like, oh, like what's Gatha Anthem's like biggest song right now? Like 59 Sounds? That's a song, right?
Yeah.
That's a song.
Yeah, so like the guys who barely know Gatha Anthem are like, oh, man, I love that song. I can't wait for them to hear it. And they go and they get fairly drunk because it seems to me a lot of these greatest hits types are the most likely to get drunk at a show. And they'll be like, play 59 Sound. I want to hear 59 Sound. And they haven't even, like... And also, somewhere along the line, like, somebody got the idea that it's funny to yell out requests, even though it never works, like, ever. The only time, like, requests ever work is in, like, in an intimate setting where the artist is open to taking requests. Like, how often does a band actually hear, oh, they got one to that jam, let's play it right now? Like, less than 1% of the time.
Right. I agree with that.
One interesting thing is I've seen the Melvins a bunch of times, and the guys that get totally blitzed, like before the show, he would think would like just yell like out the hits. They're like the most knowledgeable fans. There's like these guys at Melvin shows that get like smashed, and they walk out and they yell like the most obscure Melvin songs. You know, they're like, we want to hear, you know, Hag Me, you know, or something even more unusual than that. So, oh, I'm cutting in and out for you, yeah. Well, Narriman says it's fine there. Adam White says not me. Anyways, cutting in and out, let's cut to the next story. King Kong and the Shrines, they just released a video. The video is called Darkness. It's off the album Idle No More. What did you guys think of the video? I love the video, to tell you the truth.
The video is really cool. It's like... It's really hard to do, like, good animation videos, I think, or good animated videos, I should say, just because, you know, it's something that isn't going to, I don't know, it's just not going to turn out well in all cases. I mean, that's the case for any video, but I think it's harder with the animation and live action, but the way it's put together, and it's got, like, you know, it's got a story behind it. It's, like, a really cool, like, facade of, like, you know, like, a circus, and then, like, It's super neat. It totally fits in with the aesthetic of what I perceived a King Kong video would be like before I saw it. So, and I think the song's really cool too.
I gotta take issue with, I don't know, one of our commenters at least, or I don't know. We got shit from someone for posting this today. It wasn't today. It was recently, but like where I don't know that they were calling us out on like King Kong not being necessarily punk enough.
Yeah, just say what you were thinking, said up the buzz.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah,
so,
as if King Kong's got to bring in, like,
you want to make the big bucks, you post articles about King Kong, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so, I mean, first of all, you know, King Kong, I don't even know why I'm arguing this. You know, dude has an incredibly long punk rock history, especially if you know anything about Canadian punk rock. Second of all, I looked it up because I'm an idiot and I feel that I need to confront these things. We were posting about King Kong in 2003. So.
Yeah. There's a history.
Yeah, it's search. You just type it in and sort by date. So it's not some, you know, thing that we've come up with because, I don't know, like, is King Kong the new. The new like Justin Bieber, is that what kids want to hear these days?
Now, he's pretty hipsterish, if you will. Like the hipster people used to love him 2 or 3 years ago. I think they still do. I saw him live in San Francisco about 4 years ago, and it was an awesome show. But I don't necessarily. I mean, the young kids ain't going to King Kong. You know, he's a hipster / I don't know, indie rock mainstay, because there's him, he's associated with the Black Lips, there's the Almighty Defenders and Space Shits and King Kong and BBQ Show. But I mean, it's not like these bands, I mean, he's not as big as Gaslight Anthem, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, is that like, if you, this is how kind of like, up its own ass, the like, online music people seem to get it at sometimes, is that like, King Kong... yeah, I don't care if people on Pitchfork or whatever, or, you know him or anything like that. We're talking about a pretty obscure artist at this point.
Yeah.
Like, you can go stand in the public square in whatever town you're in and ask people if they've heard about King Kong, and you're going to get, like, exactly zero answers that are in the affirmative. So, at what point are we not allowed to talk about something? It's... I don't know. I don't know why it bugged me. I think it's... it bugged me, I think, because like I was the one posting King Kong and barbecue, you know, news years ago when no one gave a shit about it then. And now we're posting it. I didn't post the story, but now we're posting it, and then we're getting shit for it for, I don't know, hipster reasons, I guess. Like, fuck off.
We can only talk about two bands from now on: Gas Anthem and Obscure DB. That's all we're talking about from now on. Maybe against me, but actually, I'm going to brag for a minute and drop some knowledge. I love this video because it implies that the cannonball guy dies. And I like after he dies, he's like flying through the air like a cannonball. What do you call those guys? Cannonball guys, I guess. The kind of guy that in the video, there's one of these circus stuntmen that climbs through a cannonball and gets shot in the air, and so he like dies, and it has him like flying through the air, which I thought was really cool. And he flies to like a spire, and in a spire, he takes out his heart and weighs it against a feather. That's a reference to ancient Egyptian mythology. What happens is originally in ancient Egypt, the only people that got to go to like the afterlife were like the pharaohs and his friends, and normal people just died. And so eventually, like obviously, like, people didn't like that, so that they kind of massaged the Egyptian religion so that when you died, you get your heart weighed against your mat, which basically means your truthfulness, your genuineness, your inherent goodness, which they represent as a feather, mat, mat. So in the video, they have him weighing himself against his mock, and he fails. Egyptian reference. Bang. Cool. Bang. So I thought that was cool. Anyways, moving on to something people doesn't think are cool, or maybe that you think is cool, is Kid Dynamite, after many years of existing in limbo, are finally breaking up. As the Punk News listeners know, Kid Dynamite is a long-running, I guess fairly important, what would you call this, like melodic hardcore band that formed in 97 with Dan Yemin, Jason Shevchuk, and a whole bunch of other people. Do you guys want me to read this goodbye script they have here?
I mean, you don't need to read the whole thing. It's kind of long.
Yeah. I'll just say this is what they said. We've seen many bands reunite over the past 2 years, and surely every one of them asked themselves the question, what are we doing? Do we move forward and progress with new material, keep playing in the cyclical manner till we wear out our welcome, or do we take a final bow? And the answer is that they're taking a final bow. Are you guys big Kid Dynamite fans? Are you bummed about their breakup, or is it the right time?
I don't know. I gotta say I'm a casual Kid Dynamite fan. You know, they're one of those bands that, you know, I listened to after they had broken up, so you know, I'm not going to claim that I'm too particularly heartbroken one way or the other here. I gotta say that really, what I feel that whatever they do now, with any of these reunion bands, it doesn't really matter at this point. I think like once you've opened that Pandora's box, you've gotten back together. That you've kind of created this weird, unending, open-ended legacy. I don't really think you can put a cap on it with, you know, any sort of finality at this point and have everyone say, ah, this is the true end of Kid Dynamite. Because I gotta think everyone's just thinking, ah, they'll be back in a couple years now.
Yeah, I feel like that's what most people are thinking, that, you know, they'll do this and then, you know, in 2 or 3 years they'll play another show at a festival or something. And I don't know, I mean, like, it's good that they wanted to add some finality to it. It being, you know, these last two shows they're playing at House of Bands in Brooklyn and at This Is Hardcore in Philly, as well as some sort of planned overseas tour they have for next year. But at the same time, I mean, do they need to do that? I mean, are people, like, I feel like most people aren't, like, hanging on for new Kid Dynamite songs necessarily. Like, I think most everybody who's a fan of the band kind of knows that's not going to be in the cards. So, I mean, if it makes them feel better and they want to announce it, I think that's great. And obviously I support that because a lot of bands don't do that. But at the same time, I wonder how necessary it is. Just based on, like, other bands that have kind of done the same thing. And I wish I could think of a specific one right now. But, you know, it's... We've seen this before, and, you know, sometimes the bands end up coming back, you know.
I mean, I sort of feel bad looking at their statement because, you know, they wanted to make the statement or else they wouldn't have made it. If they wanted to just leave things open-ended, they could have just not played shows.
Yeah.
So, like, I understand that the band feels that, you know, this is what, you know, this would be a good cap. This would be a nice thing to do. But it's kind of like, you know what, you've done the reunion, so you kind of like, you know, you have lost, you know, it's like, you know, you can't go be a virgin again. You've lost your ability to go and have like a, you know, a big final goodbye. I don't really know where I'm going with that.
No, that makes sense.
I don't know, how come bands, when they break up, they're never like, oh, I hate Steve, and then Steve's like, Bill's an asshole. How come bands never do that anymore? In the 70s, bands would do that all the time. If you read about, like, the post-Clash breakup, like, Joe Strummer's like, all Mick Jones wanted to do was play on a beatbox all day. And like, Sex Pistols, you know, John Lydon's like, Malcolm McLaren shoved me out of the band, and it sucked anyway. And, like, all these bands like are so and like the Damned that like just trash talk all the time. But anymore, bands are so. I mean, like, I guess the idea is bands want to remain legitimate or have a good view in their listeners' eyes. And for some reason, listeners often want to think like the people in the bands they like are all best pals or in like a gang. When a lot of times people in bands don't really like each other that much, but they make their music together. But I wonder if. When bands actually are explicit about why they're breaking up and don't, like, have some phony baloney, like, it was time, or we're all good friends, but we want to move on to other projects. Like, I wonder if it's like, yeah, you know, we hate each other now, and that's it. Like, I wonder if that makes the band more genuine. I mean, look, Ramones continue to confound listeners 20 years after they broke up, and a good deal of that is because they did hate each other so much, or Johnny and Joey. But although I think that's a little overstated, too, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not something you hear as much now as you did back then. But at the same time, I mean, that could just be a case of, you know, kind of like you said, bands wanting to kind of go out on a high note and maybe not necessarily feeling the need to air that dirty laundry because they don't see the benefit in doing so. Maybe back then there was some sort of weird benefit to acting like a dickhead in public, you know, like, not towards your fans directly, but indirectly towards your fans, being like, hey, this band that you love, we actually hate each other, you know, that sort of thing.
But actually, you know what, though? I wonder if that actually does a disservice to the band, because a lot of these bands that all hated each other and, like, trash-talk each other, they were, like, friends again in 2 years. Joe Strummer and Mick Jones were friends again by 1988, and they produced the big Audio Dynamite album together. I think when bands are, like, ambiguous about this, it doesn't, like, totally rip open the wound so it can never really heal.
I don't know. I mean, people can become friends again after being apart for a couple of years. I mean, that's a pretty common occurrence in human life, I think.
I don't know. I think we should commission a study. Adam, can you get to work on that?
Yeah, I'll get our best men on it.
And speaking of our best men, who's got some good jams by some good men for us? I think you guys both got a song.
Yeah, I'll do mine. So this week I reviewed a record on Punk News by a band called Drug Church, who are from Albany, New York. Their new album is called Paul Walker, and it's out on No Sleep Records. The band features Pat Kinlan, who is also the front man for Self Defense Family, or End of the Year, as you may know them. Self Defense Family, their music is very, it's very purposefully weird. It's very obtuse. It's dense. You know, the lyrics are, you know, kind of open to interpretation, if you will. The music itself is kind of long and drawn out, and, you know, there's like bits of melody. They're very influenced by the DC hardcore scene, and like they're like 20 times weirder than any band that ever came out of that scene. So Drug Church is a lot different. It's more direct. It's more push-mosh. It's more like Snapcase and Quicksand riffs over lyrics about people doing drugs and hating each other and hating themselves. And it's pretty badass, I gotta say. I was really surprised by this record. I liked what they put up before, but This record is one of my favorite records of the year thus far, and I'm sure it'll end up in my top, definitely my top 20, maybe even my top 10. So you should check it out if you like riff filled, like pissed off hardcore jams with like really dirty lyrics, really nasty stuff. But anyway, this is track 5. This song is called Donnie's Woods, and again, the name of the band is Drug Church.
Very favorite modern band, which really isn't that modern because everybody in the band has been in music for like 25 years. We're going to be talking about Off. They're writing their third album as we speak, and they're releasing a new live album next week. Are you guys excited for the new Off album? And actually, a better question is, I think it's fair. I mean, I love the first two Off albums. The first one was called The First Four EPs. Second one was self-titled. I loved them both. I loved them. I think the second one was a little bit weirder than the first. A lot of publications. So the second one was just a derivative of the first, but I disagree. I think the second Off album was actually wilder, weirder, and more experimental than the first. If you really listen to it, read the lyrics and that kind of thing. But I will say that all the songs are basically, you know, those 1 minute long Off bangers. So here's the question. Is Off 3 going to be just like 16 more 1 minute bangers, or are they going to do something different?
I sure hope it's 16 1 minute bangers.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
They're really good at it. No one I think is necessarily expecting them to do anything, you know, the crazy or experimental. Like, I don't think that, you know, while we've been over this before, and I don't consider Off a nostalgia act by any means, I don't think that there's any pressure on Keith and the gang to go and to get weird to prove their metal. Like this doesn't need to start to sound like, you know, post-damaged Black Flag or anything like that. Like, it, there's no reason for it. I think that as long as they're having fun with what they're doing and they want to keep, you know, down that path, I don't think anyone's going to fault them for it.
I agree. I mean, while it would be cool to hear something like that, I wouldn't be surprised if it just ended up being another, you know, 16 to 20 minutes, boom, 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 boom. You know, like you said, banger after banger after banger. That's kind of what they do. And, you know, they've kind of established themselves as that at this point. That doesn't mean they can't deviate from it occasionally or at all. But, I mean, I would be very surprised. I don't know that those guys even want to do that, you know?
It's interesting. When we interviewed Keith Moore a little while ago, Keith Moore talked about how he and Dimitri running the con. Dimitri coaches the guitarist, and he's basically was the impetus for Off. I'm sure people know by now, but Off came about is because Keith Morris was working on the newest Circle Jerks album, and what happened was the Circle Jerks wanted to produce the promoter. The producer they hired, Dimitri Coates. But the problem was none of the Circle Jerks showed up to write any music, so Keith Morris and Dimitri Coates wrote most of the music together. And when the Circle Jerks wanted to fire Dimitri Coates, Keith Morris quit the Circle Jerks and formed Off. And what a lot of people didn't realize is on the very first Off EP, there's one or two songs that have co-writing credits with Greg Hetson, which is interesting. The point is that Keith Morris talked about how Dimitri Coates pushes him to make more songs in the idea that it's like a story, that it starts in one place and starts another. And Keith Morris says, I don't always write that way. Sometimes I just write from a singular expression. A song doesn't need to necessarily progress. It can just be what it is. Songs like King Kong Brigade, you know, or Upside Down. Those songs don't have a narrative arc. They just are what they are, much like a lot of the early Circle Jerks songs. I actually think we will get a more varied release with the third Off album, because I think Dimitri Coates, who comes from a hard rock background, wants to expand what he's doing with Off. Maybe not. I'd be 100% happy with 16 one-minute bangers. But if they want to get weird or do something unusual, I'd be down for that too. Adam, I think you said nobody would fault him if they just did that again. I disagree, because Pitchfork loved the first album, but then smacked down the second. They only gave it like a 7-something, and they were basically like Off to just doing what they already did, which I disagreed with, but they were faulting them for doing 16 more one-minute bangers. The AEV Club kind of did the same thing. So I'd be very interested to see what Off does. I have no idea. I'm thinking it's going to be like, well, I'm hoping it's going to be, well, you know, I'm happy either way. I love it if it was 16 one-minute songs, but if they do something weird, that'd be awesome too, with the caveat is, a lot of people don't know, Keith Morris was briefly in a band called Bug Lamp. Do you guys know Bug Lamp?
No.
I do not.
Bug Lamp was a band that only ever released 3 songs. One song was a song called El Dorado from a movie called Roadside Prophets. Another was an Alice Cooper cover, and another was a Ramones cover. What's the Ramones song? Ships Are Docking, Interlocking? You know, Ships Are Docking, Interlocking. Anyway, Bug Lamp covered that. Bug Lamp was more of like in like late 80s hard rock group, and they weren't that great. And the reason is because they didn't have that firepower. So if Off does weirder or more extended songs, I hope they hold on to the firepower. But frankly, with Mara Rubalcaba and Dimitri Coates, I think they will. So I think it's going to be a great album, and I'm not too worried about it being bad.
Do you ever want to just walk up to a crowd of people and just scream King Kong Brigade as loud as you can and then run away?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing about that song is Keith Moore, it's like, it's wrong, but it still works. Is when Keith Morris wrote that song, he thought King Kong Brigade was the guy from The Deer Hunter. Who's in Deer Hunter? It's not De Niro, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, he thought it was De Niro in Deer Hunter, when really it's De Niro and Taxi Driver was in King Kong Brigade. But it still works because they're both ex-military guys that have trouble fitting in once they get back from Vietnam.
Right.
And so that's the story of King Kong Brigade. And because, you know, in Taxi Driver, De Niro was in King Kong Brigade, and he's got a patch of King Kong on the side of his jacket in Taxi Driver. Well,
I have nothing to say to your incredible knowledge of these things.
I love Keith Morris. I love Black Flag. I read about it and all I can, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh, it is incredibly evident. I think that's why people tune into this show, because they want to hear all of John's incredibly esoteric off facts.
I could interview Keith Morris for like every week for an hour for like a year. I still won't get bored of it. You know,
that'd be a good podcast, though. It's like
it would. But he's got so much. He's had so many experiences, and he's got so much to say. He's one of the most interesting guys I've ever interviewed. And speaking of interesting groups, Broken Side have just released a new single. It's called Geronimo. And at first, the reason I put this in the podcast is, hey, yeah, we know all the punkheads hate them, and I'm not a fan of Broken Side either. I think they're a terrible, terrible, terrible band. But I was thinking to myself, you know, about a week, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, or no, it was on last week's Punk News podcast, I said, you know what, guys, I think rock and roll is dead. I don't think rock and roll is progressing, or if it is, it's not progressing at the rate it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And I thought, what music really makes people, like, angry, like punk rock did, like gangsta rap did? And I thought, you know, Broken Side makes people pretty angry. Maybe I just can't understand it. And then I listened to it, and really, this song isn't rock and roll at all. It's like a pop song. Like there's very little actual rock instrumentation in this song at all.
You know what? I think that there's a certain risk that comes with deciding that we always need to be on the cutting edge of that, or to consider the cutting edge of things as always, you know, the next progression of rock music. It's very easy, I think, to kind of buy into that old cliche where, like, oh, well, your parents hated them because they listened to the Beatles and that was, you know, horrible, you know. And it's really easy, I think, for us to go and to look at something like Broken Side and say, oh, well, we just don't get it because, you know, we are the old people now, but the kids, this is the new thing. I don't entirely buy that. And I realize the irony of, you know, that's what, you know, our parents would have, you know, been saying down the line. But I think something is allowed to just be horrible and not be representative of, you know, the future of the genre or anything like that. And I'm okay saying it's horrible.
It is pretty bad. It's pretty bad.
And I mean, I think the other part of that is that, you know, we look back at rock and roll as a fairly linear progression, but, you know, if you put yourself, you know, there in, I don't care, the 60s or the 70s or whenever, there were all sorts of horrible things going on that no one in retrospect remembers or didn't go anywhere. Like it's not a straight line progression. There's a lot of branches on that tree that, you know, withered up and died or were, you know, mercifully pruned off. So let's just hope that that's what Broken Side is, or whatever genre they play, which I don't know about or understand. What do they play? Is it?
I don't know.
Crunk?
Is
crunk
a thing? Is it electro crunk?
Yeah, crunk core. That's what the kids call
crunk
it.
Crunk core? What's.
Yeah.
Is there crunk and crunk core? I don't know these things. I need
crunk,
to be educated.
Crunk is Little John. You know, like, what? Yeah, that's crunk. Crunk is basically like the Texas version of hyphy hip hop. That's what crunk is. But I mean, crunk has been popular for like 10 years. You know.
Yeah, the combination of the words crazy and drunk. In case you put those together, audience.
Anyways, that's all I'm ever going to say about this thing. So.
Well, fair enough. The Ramones song that the Bug Lamb covered, which is Keith Morris, is called Howling at the Moon, Sha-La-La, which is a pretty famous Ramones song.
Yeah.
And speaking of famous things, Nirvana has just released the reissue details of their In Utero album. At least one version of the reissue is going to have like 73 tracks. So I've got two questions for you guys. The first question is, are you guys excited? Are you guys Nirvana fans? But more importantly, there always seems to be this debate when reissues come out. Sometimes people say, oh, I'm so excited, more unreleased music from one of my favorite bands. And other people say, oh, it's a cash grab where they're destroying the band's legacy or selling product off the band's name. Do you guys stand on any one position with regards to that concept?
I think when it comes to reissues, there's two schools of thought. One is that, first of all, it depends on the scope of the reissue. If it's just like reissuing an album with 3 to 5 bonus tracks, like that's something that can appeal to both the super fan and the slightly more casual fan, which is great. And then you have stuff like this reissue, which is apparently going to have something like 70 unreleased tracks or unreleased versions of tracks that nobody's ever heard before. This is the kind of thing that is not necessarily going to appeal to the person who listens to active rock radio and enjoys hearing All Apologies, you know, every 2 hours or however often it's played. It will appeal to mega fans, completists, etc. Those people are not going to think it's a cash grab. The people who listen to the radio aren't even going to care one way or the other. It's not even going to they're not even going to process it. I'm curious about like the whole like destroying your legacy thing. Like a band's legacy, I feel, is mostly in the eye of the band. Like it's not like you can assess a band's legacy as a fan or as a critic, but at the end of the day, all that really matters is like the band did what they want. They did what they wanted, and you know that's the most important thing to me. Like as a person who consumes music on a regular basis, I don't worry about legacies being tarnished or anything like that. Like I will always like the songs I like, and for the most part, no reissue is going to change that. So I never really understood that part. I think it's just like another aspect of people just being jaded and sarcastic and sardonic, and it's like the internet age has brought that on and has made it more prominent than it ever was before. So I think that's the biggest part of it.
Well, I mean, make no mistake, something like this is product. Like, this is something to sell. If it was about artistic expression, then, you know, this stuff would have been on the initial release as part of the real album. So, to some degree, yeah, this is a bunch of stuff that they've made to sell to people. Now, you know, I'm not going to begrudge them doing that because there are probably fans out there that want to buy this stuff. What I always get kind of bummed out about when I see these sort of things is if they really have all this cool archival material, if they have, you know, the equivalent of 70 tracks to put out on something like this, I really wish I would see bands, you know, take all that extra stuff that they have kind of sitting around in the basement that's not on a proper release yet and, you know, using this internet thing that we have to do something more interesting with it. And I'm looking at, say, like, look at, like, the Fugazi live series that Discord did, where they had all these shows. They went, they put together this archive of them. They're online. It is really, by design, incredibly esoteric. So if you want to hear songs from this one Fugazi show in Tokyo in, you know, 1997 or whatever it is, you know, you can go find that and listen to it or buy it. And so it's available there if you want to hear it. But at the same time, it's not like, here's the gold-plated 400-track Fugazi Live thing that you can buy that comes on, like, you know, 720-gram vinyl and comes with, like, a free chocolate cake. Like, I kind of like that they can go and take that material and go, you know what, there is interest in this. Fans may want to acquire this. We're not even averse to having fans pay to acquire this. And putting it together in a way that I don't know, seems a little bit more dignified. Because my problem with these digital release things isn't so much that they exist. It's that I feel that, you know, there'll be another one in 10 years for the next decade's anniversary of this thing. And it'll be more or less the same thing, but maybe juggled around, or maybe they found some more, you know, some more demos to put on there, and some poor completionist is going to buy it and put it right on top of the other one in their pile of in utero reissues. And I don't know. I guess it's cynical, but that there's something about that in no way appeals to me. And yeah, I'd much rather see bands just like do stuff like what Discord did to that live series. We're like, you know what? get that media out there. You know, put all the media you want out there. Make it easy for people to acquire. Just don't, you know, don't treat, you know, don't make people think they're buying a Cadillac every time.
Yeah, Pink Floyd is like one of the worst offenders. There's literally like 7 versions of Dark Side of the Moon on CD, like 7 separate versions. The latest one was probably the best one, but it was a real gouger. Basically, the last one, the latest one had a remastered version of Dark Side of the Moon, which didn't need to be remastered again, but it came with a live concert from that era where they played the album in whole. So that's awesome, but the problem was they were charging like $35, and everyone already has Dark Side of the Moon. So you're basically paying like $35 for the live CD, which is a real ripoff. I think people get bummed out when you're charging like a premium for the bonus content when you already have to buy the original content, you know? I love reissues, and I love when they put on like – I mean, what a gold mine was the Ramones reissues when they have like the second Ramones reissue, Leave Home, has an entire live show on it, and it's phenomenal. They only charge like $12. Which is reasonable. The Clash reissues, which are like $12, were reasonable because they really improved the sound. The Rudimentary Peni reissues are phenomenal because you can't get those CDs anywhere except for like $40 used. But now, you know, they're a reasonable price again.
Yeah, I guess like that's why I can't discount this entirely, because you're entirely right about the Ramones reissues. I mean, those are fantastic. But I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, well, you know, there was the added content that I put on there was good stuff. And those records all desperately needed to have the sound cleaned up a little bit. So that was, I mean, that to me seemed justifiable. I have a really hard time believing that, you know, 50 of these 70 tracks that have been added to In Utero are anything but shit. But which is not a comment. It's not a comment so much on, like, on Nirvana as a band. It's just that, like, if there was so much great stuff that was out there, why did it take 20 years to be unearthed? I don't know. That's my cynicism creeping in.
But doesn't the economy solve that problem? If the fans want it, they'll pay for it. But if they don't, then they won't pay for it.
Yeah, except that music fans are stupid and we'll pay for a lot of stuff that we don't need or already have.
So you feel as though some record companies take advantage of fans' goodwill, in that when the fans buy it, they're buying it in good faith that it will be good product, and sometimes it's not.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, I'm not leaving myself out of that stupid stream or anything like that.
Oh, I'm definitely in that stream. There's a line of bands. It's like, hey, John, it's got one extra bonus track, $117. I'll take 3. You know,
I mean, like, I think there's like a rack on my old CD racks here that, like, I don't know, there's 3, if not 4 versions of London Calling sitting next to each other. And like, I guess that's not a problem, except that there is some part of my brain that is looking at that and going, that is a fucking waste of money and plastic.
What do you think of those London Calling vanilla tapes? Were they worthwhile?
They were not worth buying in that format. I mean you want something that is like a perfect perfect artifact for the kind of Fugazi live series. It was that stuff. Like, they're definitely satisfied my curiosity, which is interesting. Do I break them out as opposed to the real thing? No. Did it change my life to hear them? No. It was kind of like, you know, if I wouldn't have ever heard them, would my appreciation of the Clash right now be any more or less? Not really. So, you know, was it worth however billions of dollars that reissue cost? Probably not. So, and I mean, this is why it's like, you know what? I like hearing that stuff. Give me access to hear that stuff. I'll be a super nerd and hear that stuff, but don't make me fucking invest in that stuff.
Yeah. Well, true that. Yancey, final word on reissues.
I think they're fine if you want to buy them. But if you don't want to buy them, I don't think you should begrudge bands for putting them out. Just don't buy it if you don't want it.
Well, you're said. So diplomatic. Let the economy speak for itself. I'll back that. Laissez-faire when it comes to reissues. So we're going to close down the podcast with just something quick. Is recently we did one of our We'll Do It Live features, where basically readers can sign in and talk to bands directly. We had KJ Jansen from Chicks Dig It, and it was pretty popular. A lot of people asked him questions. We've had a whole bunch of other people on too. So I guess the only reason I'm bringing this up is to ask the listeners and you guys too, listeners, who would you like to hear on We'll Do It Live, where you get to interview bands directly yourself? I mean, we can't guarantee anybody, obviously, but we can always ask. So who would you like to hear? Email us at podcast@punknews.org and let us know who you want to hear. Adam, Brian, you guys do the KJ Jansen Chicks Dig It. We'll Do It Live. And what do you think of the direct audience interview compared to the hoity-toity feature-style interview where an interviewer removed from the general audience gets to speak to the artist directly?
Well, those are two different things, right? And I think that's okay. I mean, like the actual interview where we're someone is not me because I suck, but someone who's good at it is sitting down and doing the interview and thoughtfully putting together the questions and having some continuity from one question to the next is an art form in and of itself, and is absolutely necessary and something that I think stands on its own. These other things are just sort of fun for the people, and I really like that we can do them. And I guess if there's anything that if you want to ask, what worth is there, in a punknews.org today in the day of, every band having 25 social media outlets and you being able just to Twitter someone and ask them a question or whatever, it might be in, being able to have the access to put things like this together for people. So I think it's really cool that we can do them. I'm not going to say that they're high art. I'm not going to say that we really get anything necessarily insightful out of them. I mean, that's kind of up to the artist that we're talking to, because it definitely doesn't have the strength of the interviewer's voice that you would if you had one interviewer having a conversation with someone. But you know what? They're fun for people. I like that we can do them.
I agree 100%. I don't think we have to compare the two in terms of interviews or live chats. Like Adam said, they're two different mediums, and one requires research and a certain flair for knowing how to talk to people, and the other doesn't, and that's okay. And like Adam said, the fact that we can do them, I think, is awesome. I honestly wish we had started doing them way sooner than we did, but now that we are doing them, I've been super happy with how they've turned out so far.
Brian, yeah. Who would your dream Q&A Punk News be? We'll Do It Live. Who would your dream person be, alive or dead?
Glenn Danzig.
Oh, yeah. We're going to end the podcast on that. That is the best answer I've heard on anything ever. Adam, you've got a song. Let's hear it.
All right. So these guys are some buddies of mine here. So this is a band from Waterloo, Ontario. They're called Beat Noir. They recently released an EP, just now, actually, this released this EP, called Permanently. We're going to be streaming the thing on Punk News in the next few days. This is the lead track from it. These are some melodic punk guys. They grew up on The Clash. They're Canadians. They listen to a lot of Weakerthans. They're that sort of band. I keep seeing them at shows here in town, and they're cool guys. They make cool music. So this is the song Clastic Rock, which is the lead track from Beat Noir's new EP, Permanently. And you can find that and more on the band's Bandcamp page, which is, I don't know, it is beatnoirpunkrock.bandcamp.com. So there you go. So this is Clastic Rock.
Eventually we move on. apart. Apart!
Listening to the Punk News Podcast. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We want to give a big thanks out to Southern Records and Rudimentary Peni for letting us play three tracks in a row, one of my favorite bands. Also, Adam, you want to give a thanks to your band, which was called
Beat Noir.
And Brian Yance, you want to give a thanks to your band, which was called
Drug Church.
And also, we want to give a shout out to Fat Records and Nightbirds for our delicious, wonderful, pretty new intro music. As always, the opinions expressed on the Punk News Podcast represent only the people speaking them and do not in any way at all represent the opinions of punknews.org. Other than that, we'll see you next week. And I just got to, I guess, we'll go out with a quote that I think is particularly powerful, if I may. That which is not dead can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die.